From the left, I'm Bill Scheer.
And from the right, I'm Matt Lewis.
And you're in?
The DMZ.
Dennis Rodman, I think, just hopped over the DMZ for a little diplomacy, a little helpful fence mending effort over in North Korea.
Right. Well, I can think of nobody better that I would want to have, making those sorts of diplomatic trips than Dennis Rodman. So.
And I thought the news judgment of George Stephanopoulos to then bring him on the air to get his in-depth and nuanced foreign policy insight was very enlightening to the populace. I think we're this close now to resolving the North Korea kerfuffle, thanks to George Stephanopoulos and Dennis Rodman.
Well, I mean, if he can't get it done, who can? Let's be honest. But look, I mean,
I'm sure Christiane Amanpour was saying, "Oh, if only I was in the chair, I would have done the same thing."
Well, look,
that's good journalism.
Don't hate the player, hate the game. I mean, Stephanopoulos didn't single-handedly destroy journalism. He's only just capitalizing on the ratings of what many, many others have done beforehand. But you know what? Speaking of North Korea and dictators and whatnot, we lost Chavez, as you know.
That's
and
right.
Some on the left seem to be lamenting the loss of this great leader.
Well, I would not say it's the entirety of the left. I mean, there's always been a faction of the left that really embraces
authoritarianism, totalitarianism, dictator.
Well, I mean, Chavez is a little different than, say, Castro. I mean, Chavez was actually elected, although he certainly once elected displayed a lot of autocratic tendencies. So he's a little murkier than a Castro, who's an out-and-out dictator. But I think it's the same element of the left that people who are effectively socialists, and socialism does not equate the left, despite what's on the right belief. But I think the folks on the left who are really deep down socialists, you know, they get very excited when there's a socialist in power and they want to hold up socialism as an effective means of running a government and an economy, and they look past the democratic aspects, or they might rationalize and say, well, that's not good, but let's look at this instead, yada, yada, yada. So I think you're seeing a little bit of that. You know, from the Sean Penn left, I think if you cruise through a lot of, you know, out and out liberal media, I don't think you're seeing odes to Chavez everywhere.
There's two things that stun me about that strike me as remarkable about this story. First, he had the best health care in the world. He went to Cuba for medical attention, and I can't believe that they weren't able to treat him, because Cuba, of course, is renowned for their medical treatment. The other thing, though, I will say is, and I take your point, Bill, that it's not universal that everyone on the left loves him. But I will say this: I had this experience when I watched the Democratic convention too. As frustrated as conservatives can sometimes be, and as annoying as some conservatives can be. When I see this, when I see the left's embrace of authoritarianism, which has a long history, of course, going back to being infatuated with the Soviet Union, I'm reminded why I'm a conservative and why there is, going to the other side would be, there is no option of going to that, that team. There's no chance.
There are folks on the right that lament Mubarak being ousted. We shouldn't have picked on an ally.
Well, I thought that I had a nuanced position on that. I mean, Mubarak was a bad guy. The question is, were we better off with him there as opposed to the Muslim Brotherhood? Were we better off with him having, stability and peace with Israel? I think that's a more complex question. I mean, Egypt's a hugely important country in that region. So anyway, I don't want to get derailed, but since you brought up Mubarak, Because people, because what will happen if I don't say something, people will Google things I wrote about Mubarak, and it'll become a thing in the comments.
Well, but back home, obviously, the big news here is the sequester is in effect. What people said would not would never actually happen has actually happened. But since it's happened, the panic level seems to have been ratcheted down on all sides. You know, Obama's press conference wasn't said this is not going to be apocalyptic, but it's just dumb and shouldn't be done. But he wasn't saying that all that all hell's going to break loose. And you know, my own take, and we're expecting now a bill is going to clear the Congress. We, you know, you never know. But neither side is saying they want to shut down. I had thought that we're going to end up in at least a shutdown dance closer to the 27th, that might force some kind of compromise. Now we're hearing the buzz is that they're not going to try to force a sequester, a final reckoning on sequester by March 27th. They're going to try to still punt it, avoid the shutdown, try to have some sort of acceptance of the sequester cuts for at least the time being, And from what Obama is suggesting, what Lindsey Graham is suggesting is let's talk about maybe a bigger grand bargain deal that involves Social Security and Medicare months down the road, maybe in 6 months. And in the meantime, let's just backburn the whole sequester discussion and not have this be the main point of contention, you know, in perpetuity. Is that your sense of the state of the game?
I think so. It's funny, Bill. My flight to Florida tomorrow was canceled today. It's supposed to be 45 degrees tomorrow, and right now it's raining. So I completely understand why they canceled my flight. And it's this thing called snowquestration, which is very much like sequestration, in as much as it's been anticlimactic. There were predictions that we were going to get all
this
snow.
But you're experiencing the pain.
Oh, I am experiencing the pain.
You're feeling it.
And at the airports as well. And I do understand, look, let's not take the sequestration thing lightly. I do understand that some 8th graders will not be able to tour the White House now because of sequestration. And so that's clearly horrific.
There are some other impacts that are being reported that are more significant. There's already going to be cut down of staffing at customs and airports, so the cargo shipments might be delayed. EPA's already announced their 13 days of furloughs. So the sense is that there are going to be some impacts. They're going to be over time. They're going to be unevenly felt, so it's not necessarily everyone's going to feel this big blow all at the same time. And the question is, will these little pinch points accumulate over time to a point where people feel like, okay, this is kind of ridiculous, we have to stop it? Or do they do things in the next continuing resolution bill, which keeps the government open, to give the agencies more flexibility to how to manage these cuts? And does that soften the blow enough that even though these pinch points are still out there, there's less of them, and they're even more spread over time, and people don't get all anxious and angry about it? That, I think, we don't quite know. I know there's a feeling on the right to say this proves the whole thing was silly, and these cuts can be absorbed without a problem. But I don't think you can draw the conclusion immediately when a lot of the impacts haven't even been doled out yet.
Yeah, for now it looks like Republicans sort of stared down Obama. We'll see what happens tomorrow, what the future holds. And then there are other deadlines approaching as well, including having to raise the debt ceiling again, right? So there are going to be plenty of other opportunities for Republicans to be outmaneuvered.
But this was the concern on the left after the fiscal cliff deal, that there are all these deadlines coming up that were more hostage-taking opportunities for Republicans, and they would grind Obama down. But the last debt ceiling point in February got pushed back by Republicans without any concessions at all. And now both sides are saying they're not playing for shutdown. So could it be that there's a sense of equilibrium? Obama got his tax increases on January 1. Republicans, they gave up defending the military, and they're pocketing spending cuts now with the sequester, which I take Republicans are going to take as a win, but I do think the fact that they were forced to give up the military makes it not totally a clean win. But the Republicans are sort of interpreting it that way and bragging about it that way. So is there going to be, a cold peace for the moment, where they don't talk about, the budget for several months? So what Republicans get out of that is they don't get beat upside the head being blamed for sequester pain for the next 6 months. And Obama gets the opportunity to still push on immigration and gun violence prevention and maybe even minimum wage. There's some more serious talk about that. But I think Obama was reluctant to see the rest of his agenda get chewed up in continual budget crisis after budget crisis. So he had an interest in trying to push this off, I think. That seems to be where I think things are going. And you're seeing Republicans now, they're not trying to bury, at least immigration. Gun control, I think, is a little trickier. There's a squeamishness about the background checks and the record keeping that would have to be part of it. But you're certainly not seeing either issue get just totally dumped to the side. There's still a lot of energy around getting those two things done, and getting the budget stuff off the page probably helps those things.
Well, it'll be interesting. I haven't seen if there's any like mockery on late night TV over the sequester being compared to like Y2K or something. But if that happens, there could be some sort of a tipping point. I do see the media slowly starting to turn against Obama a little bit for the first time. And it may have started with the Bob Woodward affair, but there was a Bill Keller had a New York Times op-ed, Obama's fault. There was a pretty hard-hitting foreign policy piece from a former Obama administration official who said that he played politics, put politics ahead of a policy, a foreign policy. So it will be interesting to see if now that he's a lame duck and now that the media has helped him presumably get reelected, if they will now start seeking to get a little attention for themselves. So if I'm a reporter or a writer, seen as a sort of liberal mainstream writer, one way to differentiate myself from the pack and to get attention and to sell books, if you're Bob Woodward, is to, man bites dog. And so it's to turn on Obama. We clearly saw this happen to Bill Clinton in the second half of his administration. And so I do wonder if Obama is in for the press, a little more skeptical press attention than he got the first 4 years.
Well, I don't agree with the premise that Obama got a free ride for 4 years. I think the press has been, I think the press has generally followed a pattern they follow with a lot of presidents. When you're up, you're up. When you're down, you're down. I think Obama gets better press when he's perceived to have won something, and he gets negative press when he seems to have lost something. And even so, the cases when he won things in the first term, he got, for example, because the process would be so protracted with things like healthcare reform, he didn't even get a lot of honeymoon press after that. He got a lot of nitpicking after the fact about what he did, what he didn't get, what he wanted, didn't get, or what dealings he had to do to get it done. But I thought he got a good run of press after winning re-election. He got a good run of press after winning the fiscal cliff deal and getting tax increases on the top 2%. Without having to give up very much. And now he's getting more negative press because he said he didn't want the sequester to occur, pledged that it wouldn't occur in the campaign, and now it's occurring. So he's getting a round of bad press now. If he pulls out immigration reform or gun control legislation, in a couple of months, I better get a round of good press again. And maybe that's just the way it goes. Maybe the press should not be even looking at things in terms of who's up, who's down all the time, because that's not really their should not be their function. But that's the way the American press has been forever. So
no, I agree with your larger point. But I think that Obama is unique, has received, uniquely received positive, mostly positive press. I think it's interesting that the press corps, you know, finally were outraged by, you know, sort of the guarded nature of the Obama administration because they couldn't get a photo op with Tiger Woods. We talked about this the other week. So,
I think the conservative, correct me if I'm wrong, this is my opinion, my theory. I think conservatives are generally more upset with the media, with the media's approach to Obama, because stuff that got launched at Obama, you know, types of, you know, sort of charges of scandal and such, stuff they've launched against Obama that are analogous to what was launched against Clinton, stuck to Clinton more than have stuck to Obama. And so you're in the conservative world, like you're seeing these things getting, you know, shot out of the cannons. You're seeing some coming up from the various conservative publications, coming out from Fox, and then you don't see it make the transition to a lot of traditional media, the way Whitewater did and Travelgate and things like that in the Clinton days. And so you're driving yourself, why is this working? Why is this playbook not working the same way? And I think the difference is I think the Obama administration learned lessons from the Clinton administration. They're more savvy about the way modern media works. I think they're much better at putting out fires, talking to the press, putting things in context, explaining why things aren't as big as they're being made out to be. And I think that approach has generally worked, and it drives conservatives a little nuts.
Well, I agree that there's a tremendous amount of frustration from conservatives about the press coverage and the fact that stories get reported and then they just sort of disappear. And I mean, you know, I think Benghazi was a huge example of that. You know, the I won't go into the how horrific it was for our ambassador, but it just did not get the kind of constant coverage and skepticism and in-depth reporting that I think it warranted. The drone thing is another example. You know, Obama killed an American, like a 17-year-old American citizen. Bush did that. We might still be hearing about it. Might never have heard
the end of it. So. We know about the Obama kill list because the Obama administration told the New York Times about it. You know, they went out of their way. I'm not making an argument that this is the most transparent administration on the subject of the history of the world or anything like that. I'm just talking about press management. You know, they made a decision to share this information and present it in a certain context to get a kind of coverage they were hoping to get. I mean, they're not literally transcribing the New York Times from the Oval Office or anything. This is pretty standard, you know, public relation tactic. You know, if you want a story told on your terms, then you should be the one to share the story. If someone else finds a story on their own, they're not going to tell it on your terms. I don't think the Bush administration had other ways to deal with the press in terms of talking about Iraqi WMD, which ended up backfiring in a big way eventually. So I don't think the Obama administration isn't getting caught giving misinformation to the press. You could accuse them perhaps of not giving every last, you know, shred of information to the press on the subject, but it's not unusual for a White House to keep things classified when it comes to, you know, counterterrorism operations. That's not unusual. But I think they do get they're having an easier time with it because they're not a closed fortress. They do dole out some stuff. They do it in a strategic way that ends up benefiting them.
No, don't get me wrong, Bill. They're smart and they and I think that they use, you know, tactically and strategically, they're very smart, but it's a huge story. And so just because you shrewdly break a story with a friendly reporter and frame it doesn't mean it shouldn't then blow up. I mean, maybe they could have minimized the story. I mean, again, when it strikes me that the story that the president of the United States, on his watch, a 17-year-old American citizen, I think he was 17, who is not the target, is killed by a drone strike. I bet you there are tons of Americans who don't even know that happened. That if you were to poll the average American, they wouldn't even be aware that it happened. And I'm saying that if Bush had done it, even if they had, you know, leaked the story to a friendly reporter, my suspicion is it would have blown up, and it would have been wall-to-wall coverage, debating about the ethics of this. It would have been a huge, huge deal. Some people would have, you know, there might have been calls for him to be impeached over this. And it didn't happen. It just didn't happen. Same thing with Benghazi. And I think the conservatives are very frustrated about that. And I think that you have a point that the Obama administration has been pretty smart about how they handle breaking the news and you know, I mean, hell, they told Robert Gibbs don't even acknowledge that there's a drone program, the former press secretary. So they haven't been terribly forthcoming. But having said that, I really do believe that there is a double standard, and that Obama has gotten really tremendously favorable press coverage. And it's more a matter of emphasis. Like, the press will bring up that Obama did something, but they don't drive it home. And remember, when Jimmy Carter was president, we had the hostages in Iran, you know, was it Ted Koppel every night came on? Day 52.
America held
hostage.
Koppel had the nightly special, America Held Hostage, which became Nightline. And so that was a drip, drip, drip. And I think you also had Walter Cronkite giving the daily count at the top of the news as well.
And we've seen other presidents have to endure that just relentless pounding of coverage. Not just the sort of, you know, one day story, but just day in and day out. Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? That he can hear in the White House. It hasn't happened with Obama. He'll have a bad story, and then just nobody cares. There's the death of outrage. Nobody cares.
There's a range of dynamics that are going on in what you're talking about that I think are somewhat distinct. You know, there's no how many kids you killed today chanting on the streets because there is a faction of the left that is unhappy about the drone program and unhappy about the kill list, but it's not the entirety of the left, and it's not enough of the left that people are literally marching in the streets about it in big numbers. So that's not a media question. There's a different attitude about going after actual terrorists that have actually killed Americans than, in the case of Vietnam, a more nebulous communist threat that wasn't actually killing Americans at that point in time. So that seemed like a much more unnecessary situation to be involved in, whereas I think there's more acceptance on the left that, you know, the left generally is anti-war, but if you're not a hardcore pacifist, you grant that there are exceptions, and going after actual terrorists that have killed us is a legitimate exception. So that part doesn't engender the same kind of outrage. So that's the activist part of it. But the media part of it, I think, is you look at the Benghazi thing. I mean, this is not just a question of the media just not picking up the ball. I mean, the White House has responses that they're giving to the press. You know, they're actively involved in debunking the charges that the right is launching at them. And both sides' opinions are being reported. And at the end of the day, I think the broader public has not sided with the conservative view on the subject, rightly or wrongly. But there hasn't been. I think if there was a sense that the White House was actively throwing up a smokescreen, I think the press would pick up on that and be harder on the White House. But when you have in the Romney debates, you know, the please proceed governor moment, you know, I think struck a lot of folks as, you know, Obama shutting this whole thing down on the merits. And that has made it much harder for, and so when all these nominees get held over Benghazi stuff, I think the public yawns and scratches their head and says, why are they still flogging this thing? Haven't we already litigated this?
Well, I don't want us to relitigate it, but the only thing I'll add is, if you see the movie Argo, have you seen Argo?
You know, I have not seen Argo. I saw my one movie of the year was Lincoln. So, but I've wanted to see Argo, even though I suspect Lincoln probably deserved Best Picture over it, but I still want to see Argo.
Well, I mean, Argo is obviously made by, you know, Ben Affleck, who's on the left, but if you watch
a known thespian,
yes. But if you watch the first 10 minutes of Argo and you see the scene at the embassy in Tehran and you see how scary it must have been to be in that embassy, and you see them storming the embassy and dragging diplomats, you know, through the streets and whatnot. Can imagine what it might have been like for our ambassador in Benghazi, and I just don't know that the public and the press were that concerned about it as much as I think that it warranted, and asking enough questions and making sure it doesn't happen again. But again, I don't want to relitigate it, but I will just to say that the movie Argo made me even more sensitive to what happened.
I let me ask you. I think the conservatives are having. I mean, I see more stuff on the right, not just the Benghazi, but the drone thing as well. Trying to you know lay a glove on Obama over his entire foreign policy approach, lack of transparency, all that kind of stuff, and. It feels like such an abrupt shift from the conservative approach to foreign policy in the Bush years, which was obviously you know hyper aggressive. We this cannot stand. You know, fight them over here, over there, not over here. Rationalizing Abu Ghraib. You know, hey, army folks got to get their jollies out somehow. That kind of talk. Now I'm not saying that you move the goalposts as an individual. I'm not saying anyone move the goalposts as an individual. I haven't gone back and tracked that sort of thing. But I think there's a collective sense of a different emphasis now than before. And before, at least, it felt like part of the general conservative view about having an aggressive military posture and never apologizing for America and all that kind of stuff. And now to take more of a critical approach to an aggressive foreign policy approach, I think from the outside it seems less credible. It seems more politically focused, and I couldn't tell you how it fits into what the broader conservative foreign policy vision is right now. There may be one emerging that's new and different from where it was in the Bush years. But I don't think any conservative leader has articulated what that is, so these individual criticisms seem part of a principled framework and not just trying to take a pot shot at Obama. Is that a fair criticism?
I think it's fair. I think there's hypocrisy on both sides. I mean, I think that that there are conservatives who are upset about the drone program who would be just fine with it if Bush were president. I think there are liberals who were okay with the drone program who would be outraged if Bush had done it. So I think that there's some, inconsistency and hypocrisy on both sides. I think that the drone story especially is one that I think highlights hypocrisy. The Benghazi story I think is kind of unique. There's nothing about being concerned with what happened that that cuts against conservative orthodoxy. But I think the point is that the biggest stories that conservatives have had problems with in terms of foreign policy have little to do with contrasting their foreign policy worldview versus Obama's. I mean, early on there was criticism over Obama's failure to embrace the street, you know, the street in Iran over, you know, voting irregularities and perhaps what appears to be, you know, voter fraud. And so that sort of fits with, you know, the conservative foreign policy outlook that America should always be a beacon of hope and should be supporting, you know, pro-freedom revolutionaries, especially when they're going up against a regime like, you know, Ahmadinejad's. But having said that, no, I mean, I think that this helps explain why there hasn't been, you know, I, of course, I do believe that the press is very pro-Obama. But I think that the fact that there's not like a stark contrast that pits, you know, Obama certainly has not played into the typical stereotypes about the weak liberal dove. And so
and that was the stereotype that Republicans first launched. I mean, in 2008, you know, when he was running for president, that was the charge against him, that he was going to be, you know, hugging Chavez and hugging Ahmadinejad and generally apologizing for America all the time. And even the apology tour was the narrative throughout the whole first term. And you're not seeing that as the narrative now, it seems.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that Obama has done a pretty good job of taking the foreign policy advantage off the table. I do want to recommend, though, to everyone, check out this piece at Foreign Policy, which got a bit of a splash, where a former Obama administration official essentially argues that that Obama's decisions were made for political reasons, not for policy reasons. I'll try to pronounce the guy's name so you can find it. Maybe I should just spell it. maybe you.
Was this Nasser? Is this probably Nasser?
Yes. How do you say it?
I thought it was Nasser.
It's V-A-L-I Nasser.
Right. Right.
And he wrote.
But I don't.
He wrote a pretty long piece about this topic.
I don't recall him having that big a role in the Obama administration. Am I wrong about that?
Well, you know how these titles are bandied about, Bill. He was a former senior State Department policy expert, but you know, I'm sure we could produce another former senior State Department foreign policy expert who would see things differently.
Yeah, so, man, I thought it was kind of like a sort of like in the advisory circles, not really on the State Department payroll. I could be totally wrong, but
I could be wrong too. But you know, he basically it seems like he's sort of taking the he comes from like the Hillary Clinton Brennan, I guess, camp.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm looking at his bio now. From 09 to 11, he served as special advisor to Richard Holbrooke.
I'm sorry, Holbrooke.
Late ambassador.
Holbrooke. Yeah, Holbrooke is who I meant. And so part of this is essentially arguing that Holbrooke was right and that the Obama people didn't want to give Holbrooke his way and that they'd have been better off had they done that.
Right. So this is sort of a continuation of some of the intercene debate that went on within White House State Department foreign policy circles in the first term. So I obviously totally worth reading.
I'm not saying it's the last word on Obama's foreign policy, but it could be indicative. Maybe it is indicative of something big. Who knows?
Now you have a piece published today in The Week, where you take a shot at New Yorker's Ryan Lizza. Ryan Lizza had I don't think it was in the magazine, I think it was just on the New Yorker website, saying that people should not be blaming Obama for the sequester, blaming his lack of leadership skills, because the presidency is, in fact, a relatively weak position historically. The great things that people praise presidents for tend to happen when they have compliant Congresses, not because of their unique rhetorical or persuasive skills. You took some issue with that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, you know, you said that I took a shot at Lizza, and I think that people probably, it's weird. Like, that's kind of how I think it's always perceived. But I'm not mad at him, and I took
it. You're having a policy or an academic disagreement.
Right.
It's not personal.
Yeah, and like yesterday I took a shot at Roger Simon at Politico over something he wrote about Chris Christie. I mean, they probably do perceive it as an attack. I don't. But I thought this blog, it's really more of a long blog post than a column, but I thought it was really, really weak, and it's sort of a lame defense of Obama. Of his, you know, failure of leadership, and to basically say that, well, but the real problem is that it's not Obama, it's that the presidency is very weak. And to me, that's like an incredible cop-out. I mean, first of all, everybody knows that the world is complex and that, you know, presidents have to build coalitions and cajole people and bribe people and all that. I mean, we saw Lincoln. But it's the same way if you're a football coach. I mean, you don't just snap your finger and get your players to do what you tell them to do. Not at the pro level. Not when they make more money than you. You gotta inspire, scare, whatever. You know, if you're a CEO, you don't always have carte blanche authority. You've got a board of directors or other people. So, to me, you know, the buck stops here. And there were other things though, Bill, in this piece. Liz tended to argue that nothing gets done during divided government, which does not ring true to me, having watched the Clinton and Reagan administration. So there were a lot of problems with the piece, but we'll see if it, you know, I don't know if it's going to catch on or not. I couldn't resist sort of calling him out on this one.
Well, I guess I'm closer to him than you on this question. I mean, I think there are examples where, you know, presidential prestige and emphasis did press Congress to do something that they would not otherwise have done themselves. And you said Reagan and tax reform, for example, that got through a Democratic House. You have even Eisenhower and the Civil Rights Acts that happened. You know that, you know, this is the time when the Democratic Party was split on the subject of race, and the Southern Democrats were holding things up, and Eisenhower leaned on Congress and got that stuff done. And you know, Liz mentions, you know, LBJ had a very favorable Congress. I mean, he arguably had the most liberal Congress in all of American history to work with. So on one hand, a lot of stuff got done on that basis alone. But LBJ also put his foot on the gas, and you know, if you read Flawed Giant by Richard Dalek, he talks about what LBJ did to really push civil rights through.
But Bill, let me just read. I think you're right. I mean, look, it's nuanced, and there's a mixture of factors. But I want to read specifically what Liza writes. He goes, Lyndon Johnson's celebrated legislative achievements were in reality only a function of the congressional election results, not his powers of persuasion. That seems to be a bridge too far.
Yeah, I think that's too absolute a sentence. And maybe if you had a discussion with Ryan Lizzie, he'd probably acknowledge, I'm putting words in his mouth now, but I would imagine he could acknowledge some nuances that. I think there are a lot of things that got done because of where Congress was at. You know, Medicare, for example, Medicare ended up being even more expansive a bill than LBJ proposed in the first place because of the machinations in Congress. And that was even led by a guy named Wilbur Mills, who was the Ways and Means Chair, who was against Medicare under Kennedy. And it helped block it under Kennedy. He's a Democrat, but he's a more conservative Democrat, and there were a lot of conservative Democrats in the Congress at that time. They resisted what Kennedy was doing. But then when after the 64 elections and Congress got a lot more liberal, Mills said, well, I see the writing on the wall. I'd rather write this bill than be on the sidelines, so I'm going to help write it. And I won't get into the whole backstory, but it ended up being an even a more liberal bill than LBJ originally envisioned. And so that is an example of where the congressional elections really, really mattered. And I think that is the case through a lot. People like Truman, for example, which were great. You know, they had a great style about them. He obviously rallied himself from a low point with his attacks on the do-nothing Congress. He had a lot of populist bonding with the public, but he still had a Republican Congress at the end of the day, and he couldn't get a lot of stuff passed. You know, so I think there are limits to what waving your finger can do, and I do think Obama has a pretty unique set of circumstances dealing with Congress as it's currently constructed. You know, LBJ in his day could go to the Republican minority leader and offer favors to put his friends in nice political positions and say, hey, let's do civil rights in a bipartisan way so you guys get some credit too, and it's not a partisan club that we beat over your head with the next generation. He could use those kind of appeals. That's been a lot harder for Obama to do, although you're seeing more of it now on things like immigration, now that the dynamics have changed after the election, after what people saw the numbers. That kind of argument is having more sway, but I think it's hard to argue that if Obama was somehow magically more persuasive in 2011, that the Tea Party House would have allowed that argumentation to wash over them and change their views. I mean, I think we have to have put some acknowledgement of the current conditions and not say Obama is not a magic man.
Well, Lizza also writes that the notion that divided government is inherently good for the country is a mistaken idea. Saying a fundamental fact of modern political life is that the only way to advance a coherent agenda in Washington is through partisan dominance. Well, I don't know about a coherent agenda, but I've seen plenty of examples where partisan dominance doesn't work, such as Hillary Care and Social Security reform in the Bush years.
Didn't happen. You know, they got blocked.
They didn't happen, and they had partisan dominance. And I've seen other examples where there is divided government that really works. We talked about Reagan passing tax reform, working across the aisle with Democrats. What about Bill Clinton having four consecutive balanced budgets with a Republican Congress? Liz is a smart guy, and maybe I'm missing something here, but...
Well, in the Clinton story, you have to put into the picture the first Deficit Reduction Act of 1993, which raised taxes, a total partisan vote. That's at least a factor in those balanced budgets. You can't just forget that part of it.
Fair enough, but you get where I'm coming from.
Yeah, I mean, I think your divided government is able to do certain things. But I think what you're saying, what Liz is saying, aren't necessarily in conflict. You know, Clinton was not able to implement his broader, coherent vision of a put-people-first economy and government once Republicans took over. He was very constrained in what he was able to pass after 1995. A lot of things that did get passed in the second term were deregulation. You know, for balanced budgets and deregulation were sort of the big things that got done in the second term.
Right, but I mean, I would say, Bill, in the last 30 years, you know, we had Bill Clinton, 6 of his 8 years were divided government. All 8 of Ronald Reagan's years were divided government. And that those were 16 years of peace and prosperity. Probably the best years in modern American history, certainly in the latter part of the 20th century, where 14 of the 16 years were divided government. So his notion strikes me that although there's no perfect system, we have typically fared better in recent years with divided government.
Well, I mean, there's two different, I think, metrics there. One, you can look at the economic conditions of the time, and say that this shows whether something worked or not, but then there's always debates over who gets the credit for the economy. Is it the president? Is it what happened before the president or what have you, or unrelated to the president? And then there's the metric of what are the legacy achievements? What are the programs, the reform initiatives that passed and are still around to this day? And I think both Reagan and Clinton fall shorter on that score, whereas, you know, FDR's New Deal, LBJ's Great Society, you know, those things that passed, you know, in a more ideologically coherent way with more compliant Congresses, those things were able to get done. And Obama arguably is going to have some of that with Obamacare, with Dodd-Frank, and we'll see what else gets done going forward. But the big things that he got done were done with Democratic Congresses. You know, once Republicans came into office, they've had their budget agreements too. They're all very painful to come up with, but we have cut spending and we have raised taxes. So we've done some of that stuff with divided government. But I think the bigger legacy items happen with partisan government. So it just depends on what,
right. Well,
what,
I guess it, I mean,
what
I guess,
curve you're grading it with.
And I guess it, yeah, I mean, like for me, it's, Obama has put points on the board. He has accomplished things, and yet, and maybe I'm just in a bad mood today, Bill, because of, you know, my flight to Florida, but it just, I don't feel like the country is doing that great, honestly. And I do feel like during the Reagan and Clinton eras, by and large, times were pretty good. Now we have divided government now, so you could say if divided government were a cure-all, that. I do think that a lot of the responsibility and blame goes to Obama for failing to lead and for failing to work with Republicans and either befriend them or force them to work with them. And I'm sure you have a different point of view on that.
Well, your point of view is ascendant in 2016. If people feel like Obama's leadership was, you know, we gave him two bites of the apple and we fell short and things suck now and we're still not out of this. The crash is still reverberating. We need something different. Republicans are going to be in good shape in 2016. And it looks like Jeb Bush is now making his move. Because right, all the talk for 2016 has been more about Rand Paul and Marco Rubio and to some extent Paul Ryan. Jeb Bush is now planting his flag, it seems, with this new immigration book and making people take seriously again. You know, could the Republicans actually nominate yet another Bush? And he's got kind of caught up in, is he flip-flopping immigration? Did he do a double flip on immigration in one day? Certainly the folks on the pro-immigrant reform side have been trying to take Jeb down a peg because he seemed to be throwing some cold water on a path to citizenship. What's the right saying? Is the right embracing Jeb now because he threw cold water on a path to citizenship? Or are they saying, look, we said enough of Bushes. We don't need to go down this path again. We don't need another establishment Republican. What's the temperature on the right on this?
I think it's we're sick of the Bushes. Stay out the Bushes. come on. How enough's enough. The prospect of a Bush-Clinton campaign is frightening. look, Jeb Bush hasn't been governor of Florida for how many years? I don't even know how long it's been. He shows up every once in a while, pops his head in to cause problems with conservatives, say like Rubio and Jindal, who are actually elected and actually attempting to, you know, lead and fix the problem. I think he is vastly overrated by the media in this country, by the Chris Salizas and the Jonathan Martins, the Politicos, the Washington Post of the world. But I don't think that the conservative movement will embrace him. It's just bizarre. And by the way, his idea of conservatives who don't want immigration reform should reject his idea and consider it. Oh, lights out. Now it's really bright. Let me start over. Maybe they'll edit this or maybe not. I don't know. Conservatives who don't want immigration reform should be more hostile to Bush's idea than to Rubio's idea. Because Bush's idea, I think, would legalize illegal immigrants and, quote, bring them out of the shadows. And yet it would establish them as second-class citizens. It would only be a very short matter of time before there would be a call to give them equal status. And, you know, it's a Jim Crow apartheid idea to have these millions of people who are in the country but not equal and who are good enough to do our work but not good enough to vote or to be given whatever equal citizenship status. I don't think it's good for the country. This has happened in Europe. It's not the American way, and it's really bad politics because it just would prolong the ability for the left to demagogue the issue and to blame, much better to pull the Band-Aid off in one fell swoop. So not only do I think that Bush's idea is, you know, morally wrong, but I think it's really politically stupid, and would ultimately just create another decade or more of the ability of the left to demagogue the issue and to call Republicans xenophobes or whatnot. So, but it's also just weird that he just happened to pop in out of nowhere and write this book. Like, why are you doing this? I don't understand. Please, for the love. I mean, how many Bushes do we have to have? And there's like Jeb Bush and George P. Bush, and there's, you know, a never-ending resource of Bushes who someday, you know, I'm sure Tag Romney will be in the mix as well. But at some point, George P. Bush will get his shot at the presidency. How many Bushes do we need? Why do we need them? Is it because they've done such a good job when they've been president? I don't understand it. I don't understand why some people in the media think that there's this clamoring for him, that he's so attractive, and that there's this necessity for him. And by the way, if you thought Will Ferrell, I think the more I see Jeb, the more I think that the Will Ferrell impersonation fits Jeb better than W. It's bizarre. Last point, Bill, and then I will shut up on this. I'm sorry. Please, why can't we pass the torch to a new generation? Jeb Bush is a bridge to the past. We need a bridge to the future. I don't care if it's Rubio or Jindal or fill in the blank, but you know, maybe it's Chris Christie. If you're more moderate than me, maybe it's Rand Paul. If you're more libertarian than me, but do we really need to go back to another Bush? I'm done.
I mean, do you think there's no clamoring for Jeb? I mean, I get the sense there's some Republican establishment clamoring. This is a brand we can trust. Guy's not going to go off the rails. The guy is smarter than his brother. The guy ran a tighter ship in Florida. He is not going to alienate the middle of the country. He's not untested the way a Rubio might be. He's not a loose cannon the way Christie is. He's not absolutely crazy like Rand is. There's some camp out there that wants it. It's not a wholly media fabrication. Do you think there's no part of the Republican Party that really wants this, and he's just on an island to himself?
No, you make a good point, Phil. I think that there is a certain establishment part of, you know, the establishment, the Bush people, and there are many, many of them probably would love another Jeb, for Jeb to run, and I suspect like the Haley Barbers of the world. But that's quite different than grassroots conservatives and the conservative base and the people who vote in primaries. So I think he's overrated. Like, I think that the people who go on Andrea Mitchell's show to represent the Republican side will clamor for him. And I think that, you know, that he's the buzz for him, like sort of like John Huntsman, it's overrepresented amongst D.C. and New York. Like, sort of overrates his ability to win a Republican primary, I would say. Maybe I don't have a handle on it, but I really feel like there is no clamoring amongst the kind of people who vote in Republican primaries for Jeb. And again, like, when was he governor last, by the way? I mean, like, when was the last time he even held elected office? You know,
if you left office in 2000 or 2004.
I mean, why not, you know, Mike Pence is governor of Indiana now, right? I just don't get the buzz around Jeb. I just don't get it.
Well, I wonder if the buzz is going to decline now, because here's this big introduction back into the political arena. He chooses immigration. He not only does this sort of weird two-step around where his past position was, but you know, the negotiations in Congress are progressing. You know, there's actually some good bipartisan rapport being built on. You know, there's some snags left to go, but there's not a sense that the process is in crisis. There, I think, there's a general sense of optimism they're going to work it out. It's not like Jeb's coming down off the mountaintop with, like, this brilliant idea that's going to break an impasse and he's going to get credit for. He's just kind of, you know, sort of showing up at the party uninvited and making it more difficult by having this sort of weird hybrid proposal that no one seems to be able to make a lot of sense of. So I don't understand why someone who seemingly is as practiced and astute as him would choose this horse at this time to write in on to say, look how awesome I am, how I can be the leader of the next generation. If he wanted to lay the marker down immigration, he should have done this before Congress even adjourned for a new session.
Apparently he wrote the book like a year ago, and I suppose they couldn't make any changes to it. Now he says that he's open to a pathway to citizenship.
He's basically saying, in my ideal world, what I would do is not a pathway, but if a Congress does it a pathway, so be it. I'll live with it. You know, that's not an example of showing your great leadership skills. It shows some, you know, respectable flexibility. I'm not opposed to flexibility. I'm glad to see that he's not trying to rally the troops, trying to kill a bill. But just as far as his own political future is concerned, it just strikes me as a very clumsy way to reintroduce yourself, and to many people, to introduce yourself. A lot of people don't really know that much about Jeb Bush.
Right, and the whole point of Jeb Bush is that he's serious and he's not a joke. You know, he's not a joke like these other, you know, clowns, and that he is competent. Well, he doesn't seem that way right now. It's bizarre.
I think it was a misstep.
I don't get it. I would like him. I don't know why he is. Why we are hearing about him? I don't know why he will not go away with Mitt Romney.
Well, I might say the same thing about Rand Paul. I don't know why we're hearing about Rand Paul at all, because here's a guy who probably has no chance to be president. But, you know, anyone who can, I mean, I think if you're in the media, if you have clear access to either grassroots support, money, or other establishment support, you're going to get some attention. I think it's fair to say if Jeb Bush runs, he's going to have some Insta support. He's going to have money. He's going to have connections. He's going to have some early endorsements. You can't just pretend he's not Buddy Romer. I mean, I would have thought Buddy Romer, for example, here's a guy who was governor for two terms.
And
he has a good enough, right. Yeah. He actually has just as good of a resume as anyone else running. Why shouldn't he get the same amount of media attention that everybody else gets? Why shouldn't he be in debates? But he had no evidence of any money, any grassroots support, any establishment support, and so he got rid of it off. So I think Bush does not suffer the Buddy Romer problem. He's whatever he utters is going to get some attention, even though that might see even what he utters ends up being nonsensical.
If, you know, last time the Republican Party nominated a caricature of a rich Republican, if your goal was to cast Republicans during a down economy as the greed is good party, they couldn't have invented a better villain than Mitt Romney. I mean, he was straight out of central casting for what they were trying to do.
Another problem was we just didn't really get to know the real Mitt Romney.
Well, this is true. but if the Republicans then nominate Jeb Bush. I don't, you know, first of all, I don't identify as a Republican anyway. I mean, I identify as a conservative, but not a Republican. But I don't know what I will do. I may jump out this window. If they nominate Jeb Bush, I don't know.
I'll wait till things are a little more close to election day to ask you if this is going to augur a bona fide split in the party a la 1912. I don't think we're quite there yet, but or 1916, I should say. But I'm sort of curious if that just 12.
Jeb Bush might have been a great president. He probably should have been him instead of George W. Bush. had things gone differently in Florida. I mean, Jeb Bush very well could have been a great president 10, 15 years ago. But I think it is time to move on to a post-Bush, at least for a while. Again, I fully expect Tag Romney and George P. Bush to be to be the Republican nominee in the future. But in this 2016 year, it might be nice to have a post-Bush era.
I think we are in agreement on that point.
I'm grumpy. I'll be happier.
I feel like I failed to get you out of your Snowquester funk.
No, here's what you've done. When the show started, I was lethargic and I was depressed and quiet. Now I'm angry, and I think it's a better place. I think that this is better.
Okay. Well, I hope you get out of Dodge. I hope you get some sun. If you can't get to where it's sunny, you know, it's maple season up in New England. the sap is running. The sugar shacks are open.
I don't mean to laugh at that, Phil. I don't mean to laugh at that. I'm sure it would be fun.
All right. Well, I will see you next week.
All right, man. On the DMZ.
Take care.